cruelty, and everything that dark sky stood for. We were so much stronger together. The people of FM 1960. I know exactly where I was on January 28, 1986. I was in Houston driving down FM 1960, a busy four-lane thoroughfare close to the suburb of Klein, where I lived when I was in high school. I remember I was driving through an intersection when I saw cars suddenly pulling over to the curb. A few actually stopped right in the middle of their lane. My first thought was that a fire truck or ambulance must be coming from behind us. I slowed down to a crawl, but even after I checked over and over in my side mirror, in my rearview mirror, craning my neck to look behind me, I couldn't see the lights of an emergency vehicle. As I slowly rolled past a pickup truck that was pulled over to the curb, I glanced inside the cab of the truck and saw a man leaning on his steering wheel with his head buried in his hands. I immediately thought, "We're at war." I pulled over in front of him and turned on the radio just in time to hear the announcer say, "Again, the Space Shuttle Challenger has exploded." "No, no, 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 no," I started crying. I saw more people pulling over. Some were even getting out of their cars. It was as if people were desperate to bear witness to this tragedy with others, to not have to know this alone. NASA is not just a beacon of possibility in space exploration for us in Houston. It's where our friends and neighbors work. These are our people. Krista McAuliffe was going to be the first teacher in space. Teachers everywhere are our people. After 5 or 10 minutes, people started driving again. But now, as they slowly made their way back into normal traffic, they had their headlights on. No one on the radio said, "Turn your lights on if you're driving." Somehow, we instinctively knew that we were all part of this procession of grief. I didn't know those people or even talk to them. But if you ask where I was when the Challenger disaster happened, I will say, I was with my people, the people of FM 1960, when that tragedy occurred. We choose love. Our kids were first graders. Their kids were first graders. The pain, horror, and fear were unfathomable. We gathered for no other reason than to be with one another. We didn't come together to make sense of what had happened in that school so far away from our own because we never, ever wanted it to make sense. We sat crying in silence, our small group of neighborhood mothers, some friends and some strangers, who had felt compelled to be together. It was December 15th, 2012, the day after 20-year-old Adam Lanza fatally shot 20 children between 6 and 7 years old, as well as 6 adult staff members at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. I remember thinking, maybe if all the mothers in the world crawled on their hands and knees toward those parents in Newtown, we could take some of the pain away. We could spread their pain across all of our hearts. I would do it. Can't we find a way to hold some of it for them? I'll take my share, even if it adds sadness to all my days. My friends and I didn't rush to start a fund that day. We didn't storm the principal's office at our kids' schools asking for increased security measures. We didn't call politicians or post on Facebook. We would do all that in the days to come. But the day, right after the shooting, we just sat together with nothing but the sound of occasional weeping cutting through the silence. Leaning into our shared pain and fear comforted us. Being alone in the midst of a widely reported trauma, watching endless hours of 24-hour news, or reading countless articles on the internet is the quickest way for anxiety and fear to tiptoe into your heart and plant their roots of secondary trauma. That day after the mass killing, I chose to cry with my friends, and then I headed to church to cry with strangers. I couldn't have known then that in 2017, I would speak at a fundraiser for the Resiliency Center of Newtown and spend time sitting with a group of parents whose children were killed at Sandy Hook. What I've learned through my work and what I heard that night in Newtown makes one thing clear. Not enough of us know how to sit in pain with others. Worse, our discomfort shows up in ways that can hurt people and reinforce their own isolation. I have started to believe that crying with strangers in person could save the world. Today, there's a sign that welcomes you to Newtown. It says, "We are Sandy Hook. We choose love." That day, when I sat in a room with other mothers from my neighborhood and cried, I wasn't sure what we were doing or why. Today, I'm pretty sure we were choosing love in our own small way. Inextricable connection. All of these examples of collective joy and pain are sacred experiences. They are so deeply human that they cut through our differences and tap into our hardwired nature. These experiences tell us what is true and possible about the human spirit. We need these moments with strangers as reminders that despite how much we might dislike someone on Facebook or even in person, we are still inextricably connected. And it doesn't have to be a big moment with thousands of strangers. We can be reminded of our inextricable connection after talking with a seatmate on a 2-hour flight. The problem is that we don't show up for enough of these experiences. We clearly need them, but it's vulnerable to lean into that kind of shared joy and pain. We armor up. We shove our hands into our pockets during the concert, or we roll our eyes at the dance or put our headphones on rather than getting to know someone on the train. Here's why we need to catch these moments of human spark and be grateful for them. If you walk onto the pitch in Melbourne and ask the audience to stop singing the Liverpool anthem and start talking about Brexit, you've got a problem. Turn on the lights at the theater and ask the Harry Potter fans and their parents to discuss the pros and cons of public schools versus private schools versus homeschooling, Voldemort will look friendly. If you gather the men and women of FM 1960 in a room away from the time and context of the Challenger tragedy and ask them whether the U.S. government should put more money into defense spending, social welfare programs, or space exploration, do you think you'd see a lot of random hugging and patting on the back? Turn the Garth Brooks concert into a political rally, and it's likely you'll see singing turn into a screaming match. All of these scenarios will more than likely fuel disconnection and reinforce assumptions that we are nothing alike. But the more we're willing to seek out moments of collective joy and show up for experiences of collective pain, for real, in person, not online, the more difficult it becomes to deny our human connection, even with people we may disagree with. Not only do moments of collective emotion remind us of what is possible between people, but they also remind us of what is true about the human spirit. We are wired for connection. But the key is that, in any given moment of it, it has to be real. A sensation of sacredness. The French sociologist Émile Durkheim introduced the term collective effervescence in his 1912 book, The Elementary Forms of the Religious Life. Durkheim was investigating what he originally described as a type of magic that he witnessed during religious ceremonies. Durkheim explained that collective effervescence is an experience of connection, communal emotion, and a sensation of sacredness that happens when we are a part of something bigger than us. Durkheim also proposed that during these experiences of collective effervescence, our focus shifts from self to group. Researchers Shira Gabrielle, Jennifer Valenti, Kristen Narragon-Ganey, and Ariana Young recently developed and validated an instrument to measure how experiences of collective assembly, that's their term for these experiences, affect us. They found that these experiences contribute to a life filled with a sense of meaning, increased positive affect, an increased sense of social connection, and a decreased sense of loneliness. All essential components of a healthy, happy life. In their 2017 paper, they write, "It is consistent with the idea that collective assembly is more than just people coming together to distract themselves from life by watching a game, concert, or play. Instead, it is an opportunity to feel connected to something bigger than oneself. It is an opportunity to feel joy, social connection, meaning, and peace. Collective assembly has long been a part of the human experience, and the current work begins to quantify its important psychological benefits. What's interesting about this research is that there seems to be a lingering effect. We hold on to our feelings of social connectedness and well-being past the actual event. I love discovering that the study's lead researcher, Shira Gabrielle, first learned about collective effervescence through her own experiences following the band Phish through grad school. My younger brother Jason is a deadhead who also followed Phish around, so I completely connected with her story. Gabrielle and her research team have tapped into why customs, pilgrimages, and feast days played such an important part in early religious culture, and why today we still love together at protests, sporting events, and concerts. We want more meaning and connection in our lives. In the interviews with our own research participants, music emerged as one of the most powerful conveners of collective joy and pain. It's often at the heart of spiritual gatherings, celebrations, funerals, and protest movements. Ever since 2012, when I led an audience of 1,000 people at the World Domination Summit in Portland in a Journey sing-along, I've never doubted the power of music as the most powerful form of collective joy. I still get emails from people who were there that day. One of the recent emails captured the sentiment shared by most of the people who reached out to me after that event. This person wrote, "I've tried to explain what it was like to be there that day, but you just can't put the experience into words. It was magic." A ministry of presence. Only holiness will call people to listen now. And the work of holiness is not about perfection or niceness. It is about belonging, that sense of being in the presence. And through the quality of that belonging, the mild magnetic of implicating others in the presence. This is not about forging a relationship with a distant God, but about the realization that we are already within God. John O. Donahue. Just recently, I found myself in the overflow room of a church in a small Texas town. I was at the funeral for my good friend Laura's father. There were no choir members or pianos in the overflow room, just a few hundred people in folding chairs watching the eulogies in the main church via a projector and computer screen. When we were asked to stand and sing one of his and my favorite hymns, "How Great Thou Art," I wasn't so sure how 200 or so strangers could pull off singing an old hymn a cappella in a reception hall. But we did it, and it was a holy experience. Laura's dad was a small-town hero who never met a stranger. All I could think about in that moment was, he would have loved our messy voices and singing hearts. The neurologist Oliver Sacks writes, "Music, uniquely among the arts, is both completely abstract and profoundly emotional. Music can pierce the heart directly. It needs no mediation." Funerals, in fact, are one of the most powerful examples of collective pain. They feature in a surprising finding from my research on trust. When I asked participants to identify 3 to 5 specific behaviors that their friends, family, and colleagues do that raise their level of trust with them, funerals always emerged in the top 3 responses. Funerals matter. Showing up to them matters. And funerals matter not just to the people grieving, but to everyone who is there. The collective pain, and sometimes joy, we experience when gathering in any way to celebrate the end of a life is perhaps one of the most powerful experiences of inextricable connection. Death, loss, and grief are the great equalizers. My Aunt Betty died while I was writing this book. When I think of her, I think of laughing, camping, swimming in the Nueces River, driving to her ranch in Hondo, Texas, and our silent agreement that we would never discuss politics. I also think of the time when I was about 7 years old and I begged her to let me go into the card room where parents, grandparents, and the oldest cousins were yelling, laughing, cussing, smoking, and playing Rook, Rook is our family's favorite card game. I was stuck in the kids' room, which was so boring. She held my cheeks in her hand and said, I can't let you go in there. Plus, trust me, you don't want to see what's in there. It ain't pretty. Rather than holding a funeral, it was Betty's wish that we come together for a family barbecue potluck in my cousin Danny's backyard. She just wanted us to laugh and be together. Danny led us in prayer, we told funny stories, and Nathan played the guitar while Diana sang the Ave Maria. It was 90 degrees in the Texas Hill Country, and you could barely hear the stories and music over the shrilling of the cicadas. I kept thinking, this is exactly what it means to be human. This humanity transcends all of those differences that keep us apart. In Sheryl Sandberg and Adam Grant's beautiful 2017 book about grief and courage, Option B, Sandberg tells a wrenching and wholehearted story about collective pain. Her husband, Dave, died suddenly while they were on vacation. Their children were in second and fourth grade. She writes, "When we arrived at the cemetery, my children got out of the car and fell to the ground, unable to take another step. I lay on the grass, holding them as they wailed. Their cousins came and lay down with us, all piled up in a big sobbing heap with adult arms trying in vain to protect them from their sorrow." Sandberg told her children, "This is the second worst moment of our lives. We lived through the first and we will live through this. It can only get better from here." She then started singing a song she knew from childhood, Ossa Shalom, a prayer for peace. She writes, "I don't remember deciding to sing or how I picked this song. I later learned that it's the last line of the Kaddish, the Jewish prayer for mourning, which may explain why it poured out of me. Soon, all of the adults joined in, the children followed, and the wailing stopped." An experience of collective pain does not deliver us from grief or sadness. It is a ministry of presence. These moments remind us that we are not alone in our darkness, and that our broken heart is connected to every heart that has known pain since the beginning of time. Common enemy intimacy. I remember snort laughing the first time I saw a pillow on my friend's sofa that said, "If you don't have anything nice to say, come sit next to me." Let me take off the researcher trying to be a good person hat for a minute and ask a couple of honest questions. Is there a faster, easier way to make friends with a stranger than to talk smack about someone you both know? Is there anything better than the feeling of plopping down next to someone and getting really snarky, gossipy, and judgmental? Of course, in both cases, I often feel like total shit later, but let's be honest about how awesome it feels in the moment, right when it's happening. It is a seductive, reliable, and super easy way to connect with just about anyone. And oh my God, it can be funny. But let's go to the flip side of that pillow. The connection that we forge by judging and mocking others is not real connection, like the examples I read earlier. Yet unfortunately, the pain it causes is real pain. A connection built on snark has about as much value as snark itself. Nada. When I was interviewing people for my shame research, many of the participants talked about the pain of overhearing people talking about them, or the shame of learning what the gossip was about them. It was so heart-wrenching that I started working on a no-gossip practice. Damn, that was lonely at first, but it was also painfully educational. It was only a matter of weeks before I realized that several of my connections, what I thought of as real friendships, were founded entirely on talking about other people. Once that was gone, we had nothing in common and nothing to talk about. If you zoom out from our personal lives to the political and ideological culture we live in today, I would argue that the people we're sitting next to on those snark couches are often not people with whom we feel inextricably connected or with whom we feel a deep sense of community. We've simply started hanging out with people who hate the same people we do. That's not connection. That's you're either with us or against us. That's common enemy intimacy. I don't really know you, nor am I invested in our relationship, but I do like that we hate the same people and we have contempt for the same ideas. Common enemy intimacy is counterfeit connection and the opposite of true belonging. If the bond we share with others is simply that we hate the same people, the intimacy we experience is often intense, immediately gratifying, and an easy way to discharge outrage and pain. It is not, however, fuel for real connection. It's fuel that runs hot, burns fast, and leaves a trail of polluted emotion. And if we live with any level of self-awareness, it's also the kind of intimacy that can leave us with the intense regrets of an integrity hangover. Did I really participate in that? Is that moving us forward? Am I engaging in, quite literally, the exact same behavior that I find loathsome in others? I get that these are uncertain and threatening times. I often fill the pool of hiding out and finding safety with a crew. But it's not working. While we may all be gathered behind the same bunkers of political or social belief and ideology, we're still alone in them. And even worse, we're constantly monitoring ourselves. The looming threat of blowback, should we voice an opinion or idea that challenges our bunker mates, keeps us anxious. When all that binds us is what we believe rather than who we are, changing our minds or challenging the collective ideology is risky. When a group or community doesn't tolerate dissent and disagreement, it foregoes any experience of inextricable connection. There is no true belonging, only an unspoken treaty to hate the same people. This fuels our spiritual crisis of disconnection. So just as profoundly as collective experiences move us, it is clear that not all of these moments are created equal. When a collective comes together at the expense of others, for example, to bond over the devaluation or debasing of another person or group of people, or to bond despite this, it does not heal the spiritual crisis of disconnection. In fact, it does quite the opposite by feeding it. It is not true collective joy if it's at the expense of others, and it is not true collective pain if it causes others pain. When soccer fans yell racist taunts at players or when people gather in hate for any reason, the practices of true belonging and inextricable connection are immediately voided and bankrupted. When I asked research participants about protest marches and gatherings as experiences of collective joy and or pain, the responses were the same as when I asked about religious services. It depends on the experience. As I dug in to better understand why some were and some were not, the dividing lines that develop around common enemy intimacy resurfaced. Dehumanizing and objectifying negate collective joy and pain. A woman in her mid-40s explained, "I can go to church and have the most amazing experience of spiritual connection. I feel part of something that transcends difference. I can also go to church and leave feeling enraged after my priest uses the homily for a platform to talk about politics and endorse candidates. Those experiences are becoming more and more common. At some point, it won't be worth going back." My daughter and I participated in the 2017 Women's March in Washington, D.C. For me, some moments felt like true collective joy and pain, and other moments fell outside that experience. Due to an unfortunate Uber drop-off, we got caught in some of the scary and senseless property destruction at the edges of the march and the ensuing riot police activity. This was quickly followed by two young guys in Trump hats screaming, "Fuck you, libtards," at a group of young women who were just walking down the street in their feminist t-shirts. Within a one-block walk, we had visible proof that extremists at both ends of the political continuum have more in common with each other than they do with the vast majority of people from their own constituencies. What they share is leveraging any opportunity to discharge their denied and festering pain, hurt, and feelings of smallness or powerlessness. Again, those emotions will not be denied, and when we work them out on people, it's dangerous. Most of the speakers at the march brought us together in moments of unity, but a few exploited emotion in ways very similar to the tactics of the people they were railing against, including dehumanizing comments about politicians. What I found interesting was how you could physically feel the energy shifting from the crowd to the speaker in those moments that took us from, "Here's what's possible," and "Here's what we want to believe in," to "Here's what and who we hate." The energy shifted from the power of the people to the performance of the speaker. Collective assembly meets the primal human yearnings for shared social experiences. We need to be mindful, however, of how and when those yearnings are being exploited and manipulated for purposes other than authentic connection. One collective assembly can start to heal the wounds of a traumatized community, while another can initiate trauma in that same community. When we come together to share authentic joy, hope, and pain, we melt the pervasive cynicism that often cloaks our better human nature. When we come together under the false flag of common enemy intimacy, we amplify cynicism and diminish our collective worth. Getting social. In our efforts to create more opportunities for collective joy and pain, can social media play a positive role, or have they just become a home for hate and cat pictures? Can social media help us develop real relationships and true belonging, or do they always get in the way? These are the questions all of us are wrestling with today. There are days when I love everything about social media, from the swift and powerful justice they can deliver to the endless stream of pictures of cupcakes decorated to look like succulents. Then there are days when I am sure that Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram exist solely to piss me off, hurt my feelings, remind me of my inadequacies, and give dangerous people a platform. I've come to the conclusion that the way we engage with social media is like fire. You can use them to keep yourself warm and nourished, or you can burn down the barn. It all depends on your intentions, expectations, and reality checking skills. As I started digging into this question with research participants, there was very little ambiguity. It became clear that face-to-face connection is imperative in our true belonging practice. Not only did face-to-face contact emerge as essential from the participant data in my research, but studies across the world confirm those findings. Social media are helpful in cultivating connection only to the extent that they're used to create real community where there is structure, purpose, and meaning in some face-to-face contact. One of the most well-respected researchers in this area is Susan Pinker. In her book, The Village Effect, How Face-to-Face Contact Can Make Us Healthier and Happier, Pinker writes, "In a short evolutionary time, we have changed from group living primates skilled at reading each other's every gesture and intention to a solitary species, each one of us preoccupied with our own screen." Based on studies across diverse fields, Pinker concludes that there is no substitute for in-person interactions. They are proven to bolster our immune system, send positive hormones surging through our bloodstream and brain, and help us live longer. Pinker adds, "I call this building your village, and building it is a matter of life or death." When she says life or death, she's not kidding. It turns out that everything she's learned complements what we read about loneliness. Social interaction makes us live longer, healthier lives. By a lot. Pinker writes, "In fact, neglecting to keep in close contact with people who are important to you is at least as dangerous to your health as a pack-a-day cigarette habit, hypertension, or obesity." The good news is that this contact doesn't have to be a long, close interaction, though that's nice. Making eye contact, shaking someone's hand, or giving someone a high five lowers your cortisone level and releases dopamine, making you less stressed and providing a little chemical boost. Pinker writes, "Research shows that playing cards once a week or meeting friends every Wednesday night at Starbucks adds as many years to our lives as taking beta blockers or quitting your pack-a-day smoking habit." Social media are great for developing community, but for true belonging, real connection and real empathy require meeting real people in a real space in real time. I have an example of this from my own life. Facebook and my first true love. Remember Eleanor from Chapter 1, my BFF during my family stint in New Orleans? She was my best friend in the whole world. We met when we were 5 years old. First best friends are really first true loves. She was mine and I was hers. For years, we were inseparable. Every day during the school year, we would ride our bikes through the Tulane campus to and from school, sometimes stopping to get ice cream or sneak into Durastkeller at the Student Union for a soda. We had an entire dance and lip-sync routine to Band on the Run by Paul McCartney and Wings. We cut up during Mass and prided ourselves on never getting caught. One day, we snuck into the back of the Newman Center, where we'd often attend what we lovingly called hippie church, and ate a handful of communion wafers. We were sure we'd go straight to hell, but at least we'd be there together. We both came from big families, so we loved nothing more than escaping the fray by going out together on our bikes for shenanigans. As I wrote earlier, when I was in fourth grade, my dad got transferred from New Orleans to Houston. Eleanor and I were devastated, but we made a pact to make the best of it and visit each other when we could. In advance of the move, my parents took me out of school for a week and dropped my brother, my sisters, and me off at my grandmother's house in San Antonio while they went house hunting in Houston. I was 9, Jason was 5, and the twins were 1. We weren't at my grandmother's house more than a day before both the twins got a stomach bug. Then I got sick, then my brother got sick. My grandmother waved off my parents when they called from Houston and insisted that she could hold down the fort. 2 days, 5 trips to the laundromat, and 1 gallon of chicken soup later, everyone was better but me. I was getting sicker. I finally got so sick that my grandmother told my parents to come back. Within 24 hours, I was in emergency surgery for a ruptured and gangrenous appendix. My grandmother had no way of knowing. It was just the perfect storm of nearly identical symptoms. Problems soon multiplied. There was some question as to whether the surgeon called in for the emergency surgery had been completely sober, and immediate post-operation complications developed. Eventually, my parents wheeled me out against medical advice in the middle of the night to another hospital, where I spent 2 weeks recovering. My parents then left me in Texas with my grandmother when they went back to pack up the house. I never saw Eleanor again. But in early 2009, I found Eleanor on Facebook. I reached out and within minutes we reconnected. Thank you very much, Facebook. Since then, our families have spent time together. I'm close to her kids, she's close to mine, and our husbands are friends. It has truly been one of the most unexpected joys of my life. The first time we were together again, we spent hours downloading everything from the pain and loss we'd survived over the years to our most searing moments of happiness. It was a conversation that could have never happened online. We needed a couch, in the middle of the night, tea, and pajamas. The point I want to make is that the joy didn't come from reconnecting on Facebook. It came and still comes from our long walks, family ping pong and Foursquare tournaments, and watching movies together. Facebook was the catalyst. Face-to-face was the connection. Courage in the collective. One of the things I love to do when I teach the concept of vulnerability is to show students videos of flash mobs and other moments of collective joy. What you'll see in all these videos is the way school-aged children unapologetically and wholeheartedly lean into the experience. Adults, some yes and some not so much. Teens and tweens, rarely. They're more likely to be mortified. Both joy and pain are vulnerable experiences to feel on our own and even more so with strangers. The foundation of courage is vulnerability, the ability to navigate uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. It takes courage to open ourselves up to joy. In fact, as I've written in other books, I believe joy is probably the most vulnerable emotion we experience. We're afraid that if we allow ourselves to feel it, we'll get blindsided by disaster or disappointment. That's why in moments of real joy, many of us dress rehearse tragedy. We see our child leave for prom and all we can think is car crash. We get excited about an upcoming vacation and we start thinking hurricane. We try to beat our vulnerability to the punch by imagining the worst or by feeling nothing in hopes that the other shoe won't drop. I call it foreboding joy. The only way to combat foreboding joy is gratitude. Across the years, the men and women who could most fully lean into joy were those who practiced gratitude. In those vulnerable moments of individual or collective joy, we need to practice gratitude. Pain is also a vulnerable emotion. It takes real courage to allow ourselves to feel pain. When we're suffering, many of us are better at causing pain than feeling it. We spread hurt rather than let it inside. So to seek out moments of collective joy and to show up for moments of collective pain, we have to be brave. That means we have to be vulnerable. In all my research's 200,000 plus pieces of data, I can't find a single example of courage that didn't require vulnerability. Can you, in your life? Can you think of one moment of courage that didn't require risk, uncertainty, and emotional exposure? I know the answer is no. I've asked too many people who say this, including special operations soldiers. No vulnerability, no courage. We have to show up and put ourselves out there. When the singing starts and the dancing is underway, at the very least, we need to tap our toes and hum along. When the tears fall and the hard story is shared, we have to show up and stay with the pain. And as much as we value going it alone, and as much as we sometimes gather together for the wrong reasons, in our hearts, we want to believe that despite our differences and despite the need to brave the wilderness, we don't always have to walk alone. Chapter 7. Strong back, soft front, wild heart. All too often, our so-called strength comes from fear, not love. Instead of having a strong back, many of us have a defended front, shielding a weak spine. In other words, we walk around brittle and defensive, trying to conceal our lack of confidence. If we strengthen our backs, metaphorically speaking, and develop a spine that's flexible but sturdy, then we can risk having a front that's soft and open. How can we give and accept care with strong back, soft front compassion, moving past fear into a place of genuine tenderness? I believe it comes about when we can be truly transparent, seeing the world clearly, and letting the world see into us. Roshi Joan Halifax. The first time I heard the term strong back, soft front was from Joan Halifax. We were doing an event together at the Omega Institute in New York, one of my favorite places. I'll admit that I was a little intimidated to meet her. Dr. Halifax is a Buddhist teacher, Zen priest, anthropologist, activist, and author of several books on engaged Buddhism. We met for the first time during the technical rehearsal for our evening talk. She was down to earth, and what I remember the most, she was funny as hell. As we were leaving, I said, "Whew, I'm wiped, but I guess it's off to the meet and greet." She looked at me and said, "I'm going to my room to rest before tonight. Why don't you do the same?" I told her that sounded great, but I felt bad saying no. I'll never forget what she said back to me. "Tonight, we will exhale and teach. Now, it's time to inhale. There is the in-breath and there is the out-breath, and it's easy to believe that we must exhale all the time without ever inhaling. But the inhale is absolutely essential if you want to continue to exhale." Dang. During her talk that night, she explained the Buddhist approach of strong back, soft front. As I was working through the research on this book, this image kept coming back to me. If we're going to make true belonging a daily practice in our lives, we're going to need a strong back and a soft front. We'll need both courage and vulnerability as we abandon the certainty and safety of our ideological bunkers and head off into the wilderness. True belonging is, however, more than strong back and soft front. Once we've found the courage to stand alone, to say what we believe and do what we feel is right, despite the criticism and fear, we may leave the wilderness, but the wild has marked our hearts. That doesn't mean the wilderness is no longer difficult. It means that once we've braved it on our own, we will be painfully aware of our choices moving forward. We can spend our entire life betraying ourselves and choosing fitting in over standing alone. But once we've stood up for ourselves and our beliefs, the bar is higher. A wild heart fights fitting in and grieves betrayal. Strong back. All of us will spend our lives constantly strengthening our back, softening our front, and trying to listen to the whispers of our wild heart. For some of us, however, the focus of our work will be on developing that strong back. When strengthening our back is our particular challenge, we are often driven by what people think. Perfecting, pleasing, proving, and pretending get in the way of the strong back. One way to strengthen our courage muscle is learning how to put braving into practice. That work looks like this. Boundaries. Learning to set, hold, and respect boundaries. The challenge is letting go of being liked and the fear of disappointing people. Reliability. Learning how to say what we mean and mean what we say. The challenge is not overcommitting and overpromising to please others or prove ourselves. Accountability. Learning how to step up, be accountable, take responsibility, and issue meaningful apologies when we're wrong. The challenge is letting go of blame and staying out of shame. Vault. Learning how to keep confidences, to recognize what's ours to share and what's not. The challenge is to stop using gossip, common enemy intimacy, and oversharing as a way to hotwire connection. Integrity. Learning how to practice our values even when it's uncomfortable and hard. The challenge is choosing courage over comfort in those moments. Non-judgment. Learning how to give and receive help. The challenge is letting go of helper and fixer as our identity and the source of our self-worth. Generosity. Learning how to set the boundaries that allow us to be generous in our assumptions about others. The challenge is being honest and clear with others about what's okay and not okay. In her interview with Bill Moyers, Dr. Angelo said, "I belong to myself. I am very proud of that. I am very concerned about how I look at Maya. I like Maya very much." Our work is to get to the place where we like ourselves and are concerned when we judge ourselves too harshly or allow others to silence us. The wilderness demands this level of self-love and self-respect. A powerful example of a strong back comes from my friend, Jen Hatmaker. Jen is a writer, pastor, philanthropist, and community leader. Last year, I watched her navigate a brutal wilderness with grace, grief, and strength. As a well-known religious leader in a conservative to moderate Christian community, Jen wrote openly about her support of LGBTQ rights and inclusion. She experienced an openly hostile response from many in her community. I asked her about what that wilderness looked and felt like to her. Here's what she wrote. "I won't sugarcoat this. Standing on the precipice of the wilderness is bone-chilling, because belonging is so primal, so necessary. The threat of losing your tribe or going alone feels so terrifying as to keep most of us distanced from the wilderness our whole lives. Human approval is one of our most treasured idols, and the offering we mislay at its hungry feet is keeping others comfortable. I'm convinced that discomfort is the great deterrent of our generation. Protecting the status quo against our internal convictions is obviously a luxury of the privileged, because the underdogs and outliers and marginalized have no choice but to experience the daily wilderness. But choosing the wily outpost over the security of the city gates takes a true act of courage. That first step will take your breath away. Speaking against power structures that keep some inside and others outside has a cost, and the currency, most often drafted from my account, is belonging. Consequently, the wilderness sometimes feels very lonely and punishing, which is a powerful disincentive. But I've discovered something beautiful. The loneliest steps are the ones between the city walls and the heart of the wilderness, where safety is in the rearview mirror, new territory remains to be seen, and the path out to the unknown seems empty. But put one foot in front of the other enough times, stay the course long enough to actually tunnel into the wilderness, and you'll be shocked how many people already live out there, thriving, dancing, creating, celebrating, belonging. It is not a barren wasteland. It is not unprotected territory. It is not void of human flourishing. The wilderness is where all the creatives and prophets and system buckers and risk takers have always lived. And it is stunningly vibrant. The walk out there is hard, but the authenticity out there is life. I suspect the wilderness is a permanent home for me, which is both happy and hard. A dear friend sent me a text during those harsh first steps out, having broken party lines irreversibly, after publicly wrestling through a fragile doctrinal interpretation. There is this wonderful and strange story in Genesis 32 about Jacob physically wrestling with God all night in the literal wilderness. And upon realizing that Jacob was positively not giving up, and in fact hollered, "I will not let you go unless you bless me," God touched Jacob's hip and wrenched it out of socket, a permanent reminder of the struggle of a determined, stubborn, dogged man with God. An absurd and ballsy move, as outrageous as it was impressive. My friend texted me, "You are like Jacob. You refuse to let go of God until he blessed you in this space, and he will. You will indeed find new land, but you will always walk with a limp." So I have chosen the wilderness because it is where I can tell the truth and lead with the most courage and gather with my fellow outsiders. But this limp will remind me of the cost, what lies behind me, what will always feel a little sad and a little bruised. Was it worth it? Unquestionably. And I hope the limp shows my fellow wilderness dwellers that I am acquainted with pain and didn't make it out here unscathed either. Outliers, I suspect it won't hinder our wilderness dance party in the slightest. When I read what Jen had wrote, the first thing I could think of was a wilderness dance party. I'm in. A soft front. Jen's incredible story about her experiences in the wilderness drove home 2 points for me. 1, we have to maintain our strong back. It's not a one-time effort. And 2, man, is it hard to keep the front soft when there's so much hurt. Like Jen, I've shared opinions with my community and experienced pushback from some people that took my breath away. Everything from keep your mouth shut to violent and graphic threats against my family. My visceral response is strong back, armored front. But that's no way to live. Vulnerability is the birthplace of love, joy, trust, intimacy, courage, everything that brings meaning to our life. An armored front sounds good when we're hurting, but causes so much more pain in the end. When we let people take our vulnerability or fill us with their hate, we turn our entire lives over to them. Many of us armor up early as a way to protect ourselves as children. Once we grow into adults, we start to realize that the armor is preventing us from growing into our gifts and ourself. And just like we can strengthen our courage muscle for a stronger back by examining our need to be perfect and to please others at the expense of our own life, we can exercise the vulnerability muscle that allows us to soften and stay open rather than attack and defend. This means getting comfortable with vulnerability. Most of the time, we approach life with an armored front for one of two reasons. 1, we're not comfortable with emotions and we equate vulnerability with weakness. And or 2, our experiences of trauma have taught us that vulnerability is actually dangerous. Violence and oppression have made our soft front a liability, and we struggle to find a place emotionally and physically safe enough to be vulnerable. The definition of vulnerability is uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure. But vulnerability is not weakness. It's our most accurate measure of courage. When the barrier is our belief about vulnerability, the question becomes, are we willing to show up and be seen when we can't control the outcome? When the barrier to vulnerability is about safety, the question becomes, are we willing to create courageous spaces so we can fully be seen? A soft and open front is not being weak. It's being brave. It's being the wilderness. Wild Heart. I wish there was a secret handshake for the Wild Heart Club. I love that kind of stuff. I want the payoff for braving the wilderness to be some kind of ritual or symbol that says, I'm a part of this Wild Heart Club. I know what it means to stand alone and brave the criticism, fear, and hurt. I know the freedom of belonging everywhere and nowhere at all. The reward is great, but believe me, when Maya Angelou said the price is high, she was not kidding. I have made this quest, and I have the scars to prove it. But the wilderness doesn't issue membership cards. A wild heart is not something you can always see. And yet, it is our greatest spiritual possession. Remember Carl Jung's words about paradox? The paradox is one of our most valuable spiritual possessions. Only the paradox comes anywhere near to comprehending the fullness of life. Learning how to navigate the tension inherent in the four practices and the many paradoxes outlined in this book is a critical piece of addressing our current spiritual crisis. The mark of a wild heart is living out the paradox of love in our lives. It's the ability to be tough and tender, excited and scared, brave, and afraid, all in the same moment. It's showing up in our vulnerability and our courage, being both fierce and kind. A wild heart can also straddle the tension of staying awake to the struggle in the world and fighting for justice and peace, while also cultivating its own moments of joy. I know a lot of people, myself included, who feel guilt and even shame about their own moments of joy. How can I play on this gorgeous beach with my family while there are so many people who have no home or safety? Why am I working so hard to decorate my son's birthday cupcakes like cute little Despicable Me minions when there are so many Syrian children starving to death? What difference do these stupid cupcakes really make? They matter because joy matters. Whether you're a full-time activist or a volunteer at your mosque or local soup kitchen, most of us are showing up to ensure that people's basic needs are met and their civil rights are upheld. But we're also working to make sure that everyone gets to experience what brings meaning to life, love, belonging, and joy. These are essential, irreducible needs for all of us. And we can't give people what we don't have. We can't fight for what's not in our hearts. Again, the key to joy is practicing gratitude. I've interviewed people who have survived serious trauma ranging from the loss of a child to genocide. What I've heard over and over from 15 years of hearing and holding their stories is this. When you are grateful for what you have, I know you understand the magnitude of what I have lost. I also learned that the more we diminish our own pain or rank it compared to what others have survived, the less empathic we are to everyone. That when we surrender our own joy to make those in pain feel less alone or to make ourselves feel less guilty or somehow more committed, we deplete ourselves of what it takes to feel fully alive and fueled by purpose. And sometimes when we can't acknowledge the pain of others while experiencing our own joy, we close our eyes, insulate ourselves, pretend that there's nothing we can do to make things better, and opt out of helping others. This ability to opt out of suffering and injustice or pretend everything is okay is the core of privilege. Today, I choose not to acknowledge what's happening around me because it's too hard. The goal is to get to the place where we can think, I am aware of what's happening, the part I play, and how I can make it better. And that doesn't mean I have to deny the joy in my life. A wild heart is awake to the pain in the world, but does not diminish its own pain. A wild heart can beat with gratitude and lean into pure joy without denying the struggle in the world. We hold that tension with the spirit of the wilderness. It is not always easy or comfortable. Sometimes we struggle with the weight of the pull. But what makes it possible is a front made of love and a back built of courage. If we go back to the definition of true belonging, we can see that it's built on a foundation of tensions and paradoxes. True belonging is a spiritual practice of believing in and belonging to yourself so deeply that you can share your most authentic self with the world and find a sacredness in both being a part of something and standing alone in the wilderness. True belonging doesn't require that you change who you are. It requires you to be who you are. And we feel the pull and the tension and the paradox here again in our practices. People are hard to hate close up. Move in. Speak truth to bullshit. Be civil. Hold hands with strangers. Strong back, soft front, wild heart. The mark of a wild heart is earned in the wilderness. But there is also a daily practice that I learned from this that is critical to our quest for true belonging. This practice changed how I show up in my life, the way I parent, and the way I lead. Stop walking through the world looking for confirmation that you don't belong. You will always find it because you've made that your mission. Stop scouring people's faces for evidence that you're not good enough. You will always find it because you've made that your goal. True belonging and self-worth are not goods. We don't negotiate their value with the world. The truth about who we are lives in our hearts. Our call to courage is to protect our wild heart against constant evaluation, especially our own. No one belongs here more than you. It is not easy to stop looking for confirmation that we don't belong or that we're not enough. At the very least, this is a habit for most of us. At worst, confirming our inadequacies is a full-time job. When this mandate first emerged from the research, I started working on it little by little. I was set an intention to stop looking for confirmation that I wasn't smart enough when I walked into a meeting, or that I didn't belong at a parents' meeting at my son's school. I could not believe the power of this practice. My son Charlie is in middle school and my daughter Ellen is starting her first year of college. We had a long talk about the validity of this practice, and they both said they could immediately tell a difference in how they were showing up with their friends and in their lives. Given my personal history and my work, I've always parented with the belief that love and belonging are the ground zero of wholehearted parenting. If they know they are loved and lovable, if they know how to love, and if they know no matter what they belong at home, everything else will work out. However, as they got older and peer groups became more important, it was easier than I imagined to slip back into subtly teaching them how to fit in or do whatever it takes to find a crew. My own fear set a default of, well, what is everyone else wearing? Or why weren't you invited to the sleepover? What's wrong? I have to stay constantly mindful to practice what I believe as a parent and not let fear take over when my kids are hurting. The importance of belonging at home again became very real to me years ago when I was interviewing a group of middle school students about the differences between fitting in and belonging. I shared these findings in Daring Greatly, but it's worth sharing them again here. When I asked a large group of eighth graders to break into small teams and come up with the differences between fitting in and belonging, their answers floored me. One group said, belonging is being somewhere you want to be, and they want you. Fitting in is being somewhere you want to be, but they don't care one way or the other. Another team said, belonging is being accepted for you. Fitting in is being accepted for being like everyone else. Another team said, if I get to be me, I belong. If I have to be like you, I fit in. They nailed the definitions. It doesn't matter where in the country I ask this question or what type of school I'm visiting. Middle and high school students understand how this works. They also talk openly about the heartache of not feeling a sense of belonging at home. That first time I asked eighth graders to come up with the definitions, one student wrote, not belonging at school is really hard, but it's nothing compared to what it feels like when you don't belong at home. When I asked the students what that meant, here are some of the examples they used. Not living up to your parents' expectations. Not being as cool or as popular as your parents want you to be. Not being good at the same things your parents were good at. Your parents being embarrassed because you don't have enough friends or you're not an athlete or a cheerleader. Your parents not liking who you are and what you like to do. When your parents don't pay attention to your life. Now, with this new research on true belonging, I know my job is to help my children believe in and belong to themselves above all else. Yes, there's always the work of helping them navigate friend situations, and fitting in is a real thing for kids. But our most important task is to protect that tender, wild heart. We have to resist following them into the wilderness and trying to make it safer and more civilized. Every cell in our body will want to protect them from the hurt that comes with standing alone. But denying our children the opportunity to gain wisdom directly from the trees and dance in the moonlight with the other high lonesome renegades and limping outlaws is about our own fear and comfort. Their hearts need to know the wild too. As a leader, I want to cultivate a culture of true belonging. I don't want and can't afford fitting in. In my interview with Seattle Seahawks coach Pete Carroll, I was blown away by his answer when I asked him about his time in the wilderness. He said, oh yes, I know that place. I've been fired in the wilderness a couple of times. I'm aware of what's generally accepted from an NFL coach, but sometimes you have to be bold and take chances. And there's a special kind of resilience that comes from the level of scrutiny that happens in the wilderness. I know those experiences left me with a truer belief in myself and a much stronger sense of when I'm not being true to what I think is right. The resilience that comes from the scrutiny of the wilderness and that stronger sense of when we're not being true to what we think is right is the mark of a wild heart. Imagine an organization where a critical mass of people are leading and innovating from a wild heart rather than following suit, bunkering up, and being safe. We need a wild heart revolution more than ever. If you want to dig deeper into braving the wilderness at home or at work, we have parenting and leadership reading guides at brenebrown.com. In my experience, nothing changes until we start putting this work into practice with our families, friends, and colleagues. That's when the wilderness gets real. Every time I write a book, I'm challenged to live the message. I had to face my own perfectionism when I wrote The Gifts. I had to come face to face with criticism and courage when I wrote Daring Greatly. And I had to challenge all of the stories I make up to protect myself when I wrote Rising Strong. Writing this book felt like months of living in the wilderness to me. I kept telling my editor, Ben, that we should just call it How to Lose Friends and Piss Off Everyone. If you have strong political opinions, something in here will probably frustrate you. I know there will be lots of disagreement and debate. I hope so. And I hope we'll be fierce and kind with each other. This is not a call to stop advocating, resisting, or fighting. I will do all three and hope you will too. Our world needs us to show up and stand up for our beliefs. I just hope we're civil and respectful. When we degrade and diminish our humanity, even in response to being degraded and diminished, we break our own wild hearts. Of all the calls to courage that I've asked readers to answer over the last decade, braving the wilderness is the hardest. It can hurt the most. But as the quote from Maya Angelou reminds us, it's the only path to liberation. You are only free when you realize you belong no place. You belong every place, no place at all. The price is high, the reward is great. I'll leave you with this. There will be times when standing alone feels too hard, too scary, and we'll doubt our ability to make our way through the uncertainty. Someone, somewhere, will say, "Don't do it. You don't have what it takes to survive the wilderness." This is when you reach deep into your wild heart and remind yourself, "I am the wilderness." This is Brené Brown. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Braving the Wilderness, The Quest for True Belonging and the Courage to Stand Alone. This program was produced and directed by Karen Jakonski. Text copyright 2017 by Brené Brown. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.